Welcome to Australian Aviation Radio. I'm your host, Robert Bruss. Australian Aviation Radio is proudly brought to you by Afterburner, accelerating the performance of your organization by teaching flawless execution. Afterburner seminars are dedicated to sharpening awareness, enabling decision-making, taking action, and driving accountability using proven methods developed by military fast jet pilots. To find out more, take action and visit afterburner.com.au. Australian Aviation Radio is the official podcast of the Australian Aviation Magazine. If you haven't already subscribed, pop open your favourite podcasting app and hit that subscribe button, and don't forget to leave us a review. You can visit our website at australianaviation.com.au and make sure you follow along in social media on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course on our YouTube channel. Welcome to the final Australian Aviation podcast for 2018. On today's show, we take a look back at the year that was with three special guests. Hearing three different perspectives from three very different segments of the aviation industry is really interesting, and it's great to hear about the positive outlook for 2019 that all of our guests have. We spoke with Rob Hibbard from Airborne Australia, and Rob gives us a great perspective into the microlight, ultralight, and the gyro side of aviation. He also shares a little of how manufacturing and exports are tracking for Airborne Australia. Next up is Nicholas Christie from Sports Aircraft Sales, and Nicholas has his finger well on the pulse of what people are buying and selling, and he also gives us a really great insight into the status of the industry, only this time from a buying and selling perspective. Finally, on this podcast, we have Michael Linke, who's the CEO of RA Oz. As the RA Oz membership base continues to grow, Michael shares a look back at 2018 and what to expect and what's coming up for 2019. Here at Australian Aviation, we were discussing some of the major headlines in what could be said to be a huge year for so many different sectors of aviation. One of the things that stood out for us was that it's been a really big year for long-haul commercial aviation. With the Qantas 787 non-stop Perth to London service, that was a really big milestone. And then shortly after, there was the Singapore Airlines A350 ULR non-stop Singapore to New York service. Gosh. We're all interested to see how the 777X will fit into that hub-busting mix sooner rather than later as well. It's been a massive year for pilot training, with the ever-present pilot shortage looming and the announcements of both Qantas and Virgin pilot academies. For the Australian Defence Force, it's been an equally big year, with the Navy's new EC-135 squadron standing up, the P-8 Poseidon achieving its IOC, transition to the PC-21, acquisition of the Reaper, and a celebration of 50 years of the P-30 Orion. And of course, who could forget the arrival of the first two F-35s. What's your favorite aviation moment and headline of 2018? Let us know. Of course, you can find all the ones that I just mentioned over at the website at australianaviation.com.au. So make sure you pop on over and check them out. Okay, that's it for the intro here. Let's kick off this podcast. First up is Rob Hibbard from Airborne Australia. Well, I'm here with Rob Hibbard, who's the owner and founder of Airborne Australia. Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast, Rob. It's great to have you here, mate.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so just for the listeners, it's not too confusing. We're both Robs, so we'll have to listen in for the differences in the voices there, not the name. So tell us a little bit about Airborne Aviation before we kick off and look back at the year that was.
Okay, well, we call ourselves Airborne Australia because we're exporting to many countries around the world. The business actually started in 1983, and it really started as a hang gliding tuition business, and we were called Airborne Wind Sports because we planned on, you know, teaching windsurfing, which was all the rage at the time as well. That kind of did eventuate, but then the business moved on, and it was founded by the three Duncan brothers, Shane, Ricky, and Russell, all very keen hang glider pilots. And then Paul Mollison and myself joined in the mid 80s. So pretty much just after we started making our first microlite.
Awesome. And how long have you been a pilot for?
Well, actually since 1978, I started hang gliding in the very early days. And, you know, there were a few hang glider companies around in those days. But hang gliding was, fairly early. It started before then with tow kites, which the Duncan's father, Kevin Duncan, and Duncan used to fly behind speedboats. So, it's been around a while. But 1978 was still very early days in design.
I was going to say, being part of it right from its conception there, you've seen the whole spectrum of it develop. It must have been an incredible transformation from where it is today, from where it came from, right?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, we're talking about before the internet here. So, you know, a lot of things have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what's the biggest thing that you've seen change in the microlite space over that long period of time?
Microlites are an adaptation of a hang glider, really. You know, it's a flex wing. So microlites came along after hang gliders, and people basically built their own bases and put them underneath hang glider wings, and they were single seaters. So what's really happened is those wings have become, the technology in the wings now is better materials available and design. And of course, they're made to carry two people. So you have to go through a certification process. Once you start carrying passengers and are over a certain weight limit, then you come under the CASA banner for flying things.
So that's what's changed the most is the regulation?
Yeah, so the regulation or the standard basically forced us to look at the design that we had and work out how we could get it through the 6G positive, 3G negative, and all the different rules associated with that. And so what we did is we built a two-seater before those regulations came in. We were operating in this beautiful grey area. And then there was an inquiry, the Horscott's inquiry actually in Australia, into accidents in ultralights, and that's when the standards came in. So Airborne actually wrote the standard for microlights in those days, right, which is now a CASA document. So CASA got the document, took the first page off, which said draft, and it became CAO 9532.
Well, that kind of makes it a little bit easy for you, right?
Not really, because the standard was based. Yeah, well, it could. The standard wasn't easy to write, and one of my partners here is a very good document writer too, Paul Mollison, and he was the main person behind putting that document together. But it was based off the UK Section S standard, so obviously it had to be of an equivalent quality to the best standard out there in the world, which was the British standard at the time.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Well, it sounds like you got your finger on the pulse of the industry from your perspective as well. Let's have a look back at 2018 and the year that was. And we want to do this not from my perspective as someone reporting on it, but more from your perspective and how you feel like it's gone and, you know, where you are now in relation to where you've come from. How is business tracking for you? Is it growing? Are you on a nice growth trajectory, or is it steady on a plateau, or is it declining?
Business is growing, but we've had to diversify. So when I look back to before the world recession, we were going great guns. We had 33 staff, and that was our highest turnover period. Things changed. You know, the US changed their regulations, so they brought in LSA, which now Australia has adopted. So we've got a standard, which is LSA, a light sports standard in Australia now. And those things all coupled together kind of made the business more difficult. But having said that, we've been here since the 80s, you know, same, whether we're originally six of us, but there's five partners in the business now. And we've expanded the business. We've got into flight training. We've got into importing gyrocopters. I mean, remember that the Australian dollar went to $1.10 US, was worth $1.10 for one US dollar. How do you sell a manufactured product out of Australia into that market?
Impossible.
You don't. And the other thing that happened in that time when the Australian dollar was high was the imports were coming in. And of course, people were buying, there's lots of trike manufacturers around the world and good ones, the French, the English, and now the US have got a good manufacturer there. But those aircraft were coming into Australia for less than we could even make one for.
Oh, gosh.
So this high currency was great if you were traveling, if you were buying a European car. But for manufacturers in Australia, it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
So Airborne decided to get into importing. Gyrocopters have become more and more popular over the years. Now that they're commercially manufactured and they've got tailplanes on them, and I'm not saying anything against the home-built gyros, because there's some really good home-built gyros out there. So ANASRA that controls the gyros are a great organization. But gyros were something for us to look at. So we started to import the Italian Magni gyrocopters, and we've been doing very well with not only selling them but teaching people to fly them.
Oh, fantastic. And has that been a nice growth trajectory for you this year as well?
Yes. So gyrocopters are getting more popular. you know, and it's a fact of life that, you know, the type of plane that we manufacture, there's other, we're in competition with all types of aircraft and gyros as well. And of course, we'd prefer to be manufacturing and making something and being really busy and putting them out into the marketplace, because we've got our people here that are working for us and we want to keep them busy. You know? So we want to keep airborne manufacturing going. But manufacturing in Australia is getting difficult. There's a lot of regulation. You know, the work health safety rules here compared to, you know, overseas can be quite onerous. But there's hoops to jump through, and you just have to accept it and jump through them and try and make your business more efficient. And that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. And what about the exports in 2018? Have you been selling much stuff overseas, or has it been more domestic?
No, most of our market is overseas, and a big portion of our market is in China. And we've been selling into China for 20 years. We basically helped set up the Chinese market in that the Chinese came over. There were five of them first off, and we taught them to fly. And then we followed up on that in the great days of the Export Development Grant, when it was uncapped. It worked really, really well. We sent instructors to China to teach these people, to give them more experience and train the trainer.
Yep.
And we did that for a long period of time. And there's more Microlite pilots now in China, experienced Microlite pilots, young guys, than there are anywhere in the world. And it's been a great thing. We've sold a lot of from the Microlites over there, and we still do. It's also opened the market up for our competitors too, because we did all the groundwork initially. But
typical, you know, right?
That's fine. I mean, with competitors, I mean, I look at other Microlite manufacturers, and I don't actually see them as a direct competitor. We're trying to persuade people to fly a Microlite over, say, a similar weight light sport aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
This is more fun. Breeze in your face, very simple controls, very natural. And we're all promoting the same thing. So I always try to get the Microlite manufacturers, when I go overseas, to work together to promote all of our products together, because we're not really in competition with each other. We should be working together.
You're in competition with the LSA market, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So gyrocopters, in a way, and fixed wing. Yeah, so you've got a lot of planes that are similar weight to us, like the Foxbat, which has been very successful and is a very nice aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, have you put lots of little Microlites into containers and shipped them off overseas this year?
Yes, we have. Yeah. So again, you know, most of those have gone to China, but we've also we're starting to rebuild our US market. So we used to have something like 20 dealers around the US, and when LSA came in, it changed the rules and it made it difficult for a lot of the guys, which were just weekend operators. And those weekend operators, when you put them all together and they're teaching a person to fly here and there, and then they sell, say, one a year or something, or one or two a year, and you add all of those up, it's a good chunk of your business. So once you lose those guys, they don't come back. So, but there's some really good schools in the States that are, you know, the biggest schools survive, of course. And yeah, and they're buying, some of those guys are buying our products.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And if you go to Hawaii and you want to go for they call them powered hang gliders over there, because that kind of attracts the tourists. You know, somebody wants to go and do something extreme, so they're going to go and do powered hang gliding rather than microlighting.
Yeah.
They go to Oahu on the North Shore and fly with Tom and Denise Sanders over there, and they're flying. They've got four of our aircraft on the go. And on Maui, we've got Armin. In Maui, that actually flies to his airstrip in a Cessna to take people on joyride. Well, they're actually trying instructional flights in his Microlite.
Very nice.
And it's a full-time business, you know.
Yeah, very nice. So, excellent. Yeah. And what about the industry here in Australia? As you look back at 2018 and the year that was, and where we started and where we are today, right here at the close of the year, at the end of the calendar year, have you seen it change much? What's the pulse of the industry? It seems like you're pretty close to it, and you're certainly deep in it. What are you feeling? Is it good, bad, indifferent?
It's good. I think that, you know, social media is brilliant for flying. You know.
Yeah.
People jump on YouTube and they see these beautiful videos of people flying along beaches or, you know, wherever, over deserts. And they can be anywhere in the world looking at these videos and thinking, gee, I wouldn't mind doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the social media side of it is very powerful. So, and we're very involved in that. You know, we run quite a few websites and Facebook pages, and Instagram. But when you look at Instagram and Facebook, and you see how many people out there are actually flying my flights. And so if you can get some information to those people, we're in Australia, guys. And the fact is that Airborne's a well-known name all around the world. If somebody's looking to fly a light sport plane, they will find Airborne. You know, our website gets a lot of hits. It gets 2,600 hits a month. Used to get more. Okay. So things got a bit tight and we're coming back now. You know, so I'm very positive about the future. I think that 2018 was similar to 2017 in as far as sales and that. But I can feel that, you know, we will pick up in 2019.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it's great to hear a positive news story and a positive report from somebody at the coalface in the industry as well. Is there something that's exciting on the development horizon for you guys in 2019, or is it just more of the same?
We're always developing. We don't stop. You know, we use the R&D grant and, you know, where you can claw back your, you know, any losses that you have. And we're always improving the products that we've got. We have got some ideas, but we've got this new aircraft out now called Microlite, you call the M4. It's going really well for us. We've made it so that taller pilots can fit in it. We're all shorties here. So we're in the past, our planes have always kind of fitted us really well. But we're finding that there's, you know, in the States in particular, you know, you've got guys that are 6'4", 6'6", you know, and they're training, they're teaching people, you've got to make it comfortable for them as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
So we've done that with our new model, but yeah, we'll there'll be some new things come out in next year.
Oh, that's good. That's awesome that there's enough business there to keep that development cycle moving forward for you as well, because that's how that technology advances. That's how aviation advances as well. So well done to you guys and kudos for you for keeping on doing that. It's great. It's great to hear.
Thank you.
Awesome. I had to check myself when I was doing a little bit of research for this quick interview that we're doing here, and just looking at your website and watching a couple of videos and seeing Microlite. And I've been in and around aviation my whole entire life. I'm a private pilot and, you know, I used to be a paratrooper in the military. So I've got a lot of experience doing a lot of different types of aviation related things. How much do you have to be pretty brave to get into a Microlite if you've never done that before? Because it kind of struck me as something like, oh my God, you know, like, and they're not, you know, even if you're at 500 feet, that doesn't sound high, but when you're out knees in the breeze, so to speak, as we used to say in the army, it's like kind of pretty scary.
You don't feel like that when you're in a Microlite. There's such a stable platform, and that's what people comment on, you know, because in a Microlite, it's weight shift, so the wing's not, it's connected obviously to the base, but the wing moves around independently of the base. So the way you control them is you move the weight over, which moves the base, and then the wing flies. But all it feels like really is that when you're flying them, you've got a control bar, and it's like a joystick upside down. Mm-hmm. So you're doing these minute movements, and the plane's reacting to that. But the thing with a Microlite, and any aircraft really, if you let go of the stick or of the control frame, it'll fly straight and level. Yeah. Or if you backed off to idle, it'll be descending, but it will be stable. If you push the control frame away from you and let it go, it will come back. And the same is if you pull it in. You can literally throw the control bar over to one side and the wing will rock around and it'll settle back to that. Let's call it trim, you know. So they're a very stable platform. And when you take people flying in them, they always comment on, oh, wow, how wonderfully smooth this is. In a fixed wing, because your fuselage is connected, so you're getting rocked around as the wings rock around. But in a Microlite, you'll get the wings moving around, but the base that you're sitting in will remain stable. Mm-hmm. Now, not all the time. If you get enough turbulence, you'll get moved around. It's a light aircraft. So,
well, that was my next question. Do you get bounced around in the turbulence with it more than you would like in a little plane, or is it just ride the waves of the wind like every other plane does?
You get bounced around as much as you would in any fixed wing plane. Okay, in a certain amount of turbulence. So in light turbulence, you don't feel it. The wing reacts to it, and it doesn't come through the base. Whereas in most light aircraft, you'll feel it with the rocking. In heavy turbulence, of course, yes, you're going to get bounced around. And the heavier the aircraft that you fly, the less it's influenced by the heavier turbulence. Mm-hmm. In a gyrocopter, for instance, you hardly feel any, even in fairly heavy turbulence, you hardly feel that. So gyrocopters can be out there flying in very strong conditions. And sometimes, you know, flying from the airport we are, most of the aircraft will be on the ground and the gyros will still be out there flying. And so that's one of the appeals for, you know, flying gyrocopters. having said that, you know, you can't get any more a natural feel if the conditions are right. Flying a Microlite is just sensational. And I fly both of them. You know, I love flying. You know, I haven't got a fixed wing license, but, you know, I'll go down that track and get one of those. Get a bit long in the tooth, but I've still got enough time left in me to do that, you know.
Yeah, I have to say, I felt that's what it made me feel when I was watching some of the videos. It was like these things really look like that's like what flying feels like. It's really natural. You know, you've got this small engine that's behind you, but that wing and the way that you're controlling it is quite different to the way you can, it looks different to the way that you're controlling a normal aeroplane with your kind of hands and feet type thing. And it looks like a lot of fun, and it certainly makes for some spectacular photos. What type of range do they have? I don't know much about these things. Can you go a long way in these things?
Yeah, so you've got about 500 nautical miles. So
wow, long way.
So the Microlites are probably one of the most used aircraft from flying around the world, you know, in light sport.
Yep.
So there's a lot of people flown from England to Australia in Microlites. And about 3 or 4 years ago, a fellow did it. He was in a wheelchair.
Gosh.
And he flew. So the longest crossing you've got is the Timor Sea. So you've got to get, you know, you need 6 hours of fuel to get across the Timor Sea. So the standard fuel tanks in these things will do that. Of course, if you've got a headwind, then you may not make it. So Dave Sykes that flew from England to Australia had a big fuel tank in the back as well. But when he did cross the Timor Sea, he was planning to go to Darwin, but the strong headwind, so he had to go into the RAF base up there, Tyndall, I think.
Up in Tyndall.
And so he, but he made it, and he made it to Newcastle, you know, and then he wanted to end his journey there. And I said, you can't do that. You've got to fly to Sydney, you know, and that's when we got Dick Smith involved. You know, Dick's is an avid trike pilot as well. He used to have two of our aircraft. He's down to one now, but he loves flying them. And he helped us get Dave to be able to fly over the Harbour Bridge and into Bankstown. And that went around 40 different countries around the world. It went viral. So it put Dave on the map.
And ultralight trikes as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And trikes, you know, and he wasn't flying one of our planes. He was flying an English model, but it doesn't matter. You know, he was flying a trike and he did something wonderful. So, and there's been a few others, and there's actually been a Microlite that's flown all the way around the world, you know, as well. I mean, personally, I've flown them in lots of, I mean, airborne's been a wonderful journey for me and my partners. And, we've been together for a long time, and we've all had this amazing experience flying hang gliders in the Alps in Austria and France and Switzerland, but also with Microlites. You know, we've all flown our Microlites all around the world. And personally, I've flown all the way around Israel in a Microlite. Down to the Dead Sea, you know, because we were selling a lot there. We were selling a lot in Alaska, so at the time, and so went to Alaska and flew around Alaska. And I've actually flown from a place, Telford near Birmingham, across the Irish Sea, and delivered one to a fellow in Enniskillen near Belfast. And I've just been talking to him via email, and you know, just remembering those things, those flights that we did.
It's certainly a wonderful and captivating way to be involved in aviation. Rob, if people are interested in finding out more about becoming a Microlite pilot or buying one of your machines, where can they find out more information?
Okay, well, Airborne, there are a few Microlite schools around Australia, and Airborne's got its own school too, operating out of Lake Macquarie Airport. So we've got the website Airborne, which is airborne.com.au, and then we've got Airborne Flight Training, which is airborneflighttraining.com.au. And sure, we can, if you call us, we can book you in, take you on a trial flight initially.
What's that worth? What's a trial instructional flight in a Microlite worth? Must be cheap.
They start up around $95.
Really cheap.
But you know, if you want the hour flight, then you're up around the $300 mark.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at Lake Macquarie Airport, you can go for a Microlite flight, a helicopter flight, a skydive. You know, so there's a few things. The ultimate flight as well with Matt Hall. You know, if you want to pull a few G's, like aerobatics.
Mm. Excellent. Well, Rob, I'll make sure that those links are included in the show notes, and we really appreciate you coming on the Australian Aviation Podcast and taking a look back at 2018 and the year that was. And it sounds like it's been really positive for your business, and it's been great for your industry as well. So, thanks again for coming on, mate. We look forward to speaking with you again soon. Bye for now.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, I'm here with Nicholas Christie from Sport Aircraft Sales. Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast, Nicholas. It's great to have you on this 2018 wrap-up version.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
All right. I'd like to start off with all of my guests with a little quick little get to know you. Tell us a little bit about your involvement in aviation. Where did it all start out for you? And how did you end up where you are now with the sport aircraft sales business?
How long have I got? Well, I started about in my 20s. I'm now in my early 40s as a 13-year-old and down in Moorabbin Airport, and learned to fly and then decided to do it as a career. I wanted to go into the airlines, so I got my commercial license by 18 and then was a flying instructor for about 4 years, and built up my hours and my experience as a young 22, 23-year-old. And I wanted to go into aviation commercially, but then realised it wasn't for me for whatever reason. But I kept flying for a few years after that. And then I suppose I took a break. I went overseas and did some other stuff. And like a lot of people, came back to it, and really only came back to it a couple of years ago. So, but that was just as a private pilot, you know.
Well, how did you get back into it? Did you just decide one day, hey, I'm going to go and get current, get my medical, go and get an ASIC, go and take a plane out for a spin?
Pretty much. Oh, I've got something to say about ASICs. I haven't got one yet, but I should get one probably. I've applied. That's a whole different story. But, I just decided, I love it. I love it. There's something in my blood. I just like flying. I like the freedom of flying. Mm-hmm. I like what it does for the mind. And so really for me, it was a personal decision. Let's get back in and start flying. And I'm very passionate about what is now recreational aviation. Mm-hmm. And just being a private pilot and being able to responsibly get in a plane and go somewhere.
There's not too many things better than that, is there? Being able to head out to the airport, whether that's with some mates or some family or on your own, and just head out and go somewhere, that's a pretty empowering thing, if you ask me.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the most wonderful things to be able to do. And if you've got the privilege to be able to do it in a wonderful country like Australia, then why not? It's a wonderful view up there.
Where's your home aerodrome?
Tyab Western Port Airfield, or I'm not sure what we call it now, Mornington Peninsula Aerodrome, which is a wonderful facility, actually. Great membership and really good social atmosphere there. So I really enjoy it. Of course, there's the social side of flying too, isn't there? Yeah, where, absolutely. You know, you can join a club and be there with people who like to do the same stuff as you.
And that is probably one of the most scenic parts of Australia to fly a little aeroplane around, right?
I agree. There isn't a day that goes by where I don't say to my, and I don't like flying on my own too much. I like to share the experience where you just look down and you literally say to the other bloke or the other lady, geez, we're lucky. Like, look at what we're looking at here. I know it's our home. This is where we grew up, but wow, it's so spectacular. And the fact that we've got the freedom, particularly in relation to controlled airspace, so much Class G airspace, and you can just go wherever you want and as high as you like, pretty much, or as low as you like within reason.
What about the weather around there? It's pretty frontal around that part.
Yes, we're very good crosswind pilots. We know
how it would be.
Crosswind. So we're always looking at the weather. It's, you know, we've got the grass strip which runs across, but we don't use it all that much. Yeah, you've got it. You get weather coming in, but thankfully you can see it coming over the bay. Mm. So you just learn to look west, and if it's coming through, well, then you land and have a coffee.
You ever get caught out there?
Oh, I haven't, thankfully, no. And I've had a very good career and I've got a couple of thousand hours, and I've been very privileged to have been never caught out with significant weather or any problems, touch wood. So I think you've got to be responsible, you know, and have fun, but do it responsibly. It's the same with driving a car, or, you know, just be responsible and have fun. That's the main thing. We all care about each other as well. You know, as pilots, I don't know someone who's irresponsible and unsafe and silly about what they do. And if we see something that's really bad, we'll just say it to a friend, you know, look, you had a couple of drinks last night, maybe you shouldn't fly, or whatever it is.
Beautifully said. And it's honest and it's straight up. And that's exactly the way it should be. So that's nice.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about your business and how did you get into selling aeroplanes? That was like a dream job, and for others it could be like the worst nightmare.
Do you know what? It's my dream job. And I never thought I'd ever say that. I wake up in the morning and I'm absolutely, I don't go far because I work from home, but I wake up in the morning and I'm really happy. Look, the story is this. I was general manager for a company. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if any of the listeners out there are in corporate life, but they're sort of wondering why they're still in it. Some people love it. Great. But I didn't. I don't do well in corporate. I don't do well politically with that sort of stuff. So, because usually
don't play nicely with others.
Yes, play nicely. Even if you've got a really strong opinion, don't say it. Nah, that doesn't gel with me. So, look, I got out of it, and I decided, right, I was actually lying on the beach in St Kilda. There was a moment in time, and I wrote a list of what do I love, mm-hmm. and what am I good at. Two separate lists on my little phone, and I joined the two together. And it was basically a light bulb moment. And I said, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sell aeroplanes because I'm good at sales. I'm good at marketing. And
have
I love aeroplanes.
Have you ever sold aeroplanes before or worked in that space?
Never. I'd sold education, spas, vacuum cleaners. Yes, I was a vacuum cleaner salesperson. But and I decided, no, this is the life. And look, I started it in, early last year anyway, and it's going okay. I really enjoy it. And of course, we've got the Aero Momentum experimental motors, which are great as well. So we're the agent for that as well. So
yeah, let's get into that in a minute. Let's talk about the aeroplane sales, because this is the 2018 wrap up. Thanks for giving us a little bit of background and context there. How have the sales progressed for you this year as compared to last year? You know, what does the market sentiment look like? Is it positive? Is it growing? Is it on a downward or an upward trajectory? What would you say?
Well, I'm always positive, right? So I wake up in the morning with a smile on my face, and I always look to the future, and I've got faith in the fact that it's always going to get better. Having said that, I've got to be honest with you. The market is depressed.
Depressed from a sales perspective, like people wanting to buy planes or people wanting to sell their planes? Because when I was looking at, you know, there's two sides to it in a marketplace like that. Are you seeing it depressed from a sales side or from a listing side?
Look, I've got plenty of listings. I don't really have to work on the listing side of things as much as I used to when I started, obviously. We're quite well known, sportaircraftsales.com.au. Everyone goes there. I mean, I look at my analytics and you've got, 300 people a day on the site. Problem is a lot of people are moving from VH to RAOs. Mm-hmm. When I say problem, it's not a problem in so much as recreational flying is concerned, but I think the costs associated with VH aircraft now and the legislative framework around that is prohibitive. So I'm getting a lot of VH owners saying, you know what, I'm just going to go to RAOs. So have you got a little aeroplane for me? I just want to fly it around. Or I've got a medical issue. It's mainly medical issues.
Right.
So people who list with me will say, look, I've got this plane, I love it, but I've switched it into RAOs because, my Damie can't give me a medical. I just can't fly anymore. I love flying, Nicholas. I get that. What would I do with my life if I couldn't fly? So I have to go to RAOs. So we get a lot of that. What that does is it increases supply, and it's just a supply and demand thing. So where there's more supply, the market sort of says, all right, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you 10% less for that aeroplane. It's simple economics. So when I say depressed, people are still flying. It's just there's a shift from VH to RAOs, particularly from last year to this year. I'm noticing it.
What would you say in terms of percentages?
Most of the aircraft that I have are VH aircraft, I would say. Well, probably 50-50, to be honest, but there's been a huge increase in VH aircraft, VH sport experimental aircraft, and people shifting to RAOs and saying, look, I need to get rid of this aircraft. Help me. So that's what I do. But then on the other side of the equation, we've got people saying, well, yeah, I'll buy your aeroplane, but I'm not going to spend $100,000. I'll spend 80 or 85. And so the market's readjusting. It's just a simple economic fact.
And you're just in the middle of it, facilitating it all, right?
I'm a facilitator. So I'm in the middle. I'm saying, okay, buyer, look, I'll see if I can get you a deal, but I work on behalf of the other bloke, right? Or the other lady who's selling the aeroplane. And for that person, I'm saying, well, I'll try and get you the best price, but I have to tell you, the market's telling me that you might not get what you want. Mm-hmm. Just right at the moment. There are some exceptions. For instance, 12 months ago, I couldn't give away RV7s and RV6s. Very popular aeroplane, fabulous aircraft. Now I can't get one to sell. So if anyone out there wants to give me a nice RV7, just let me know because I'll sell it tomorrow for you at probably a very good price.
Marketplaces and sales are always swings and roundabouts, aren't they? You have good quarters and bad quarters in particular line items on a balance sheet, so to speak. It just comes in swings and roundabouts. So I'm curious, do you operate the other way around as like a buyer's agent on behalf of somebody looking to purchase an RV12?
Can you get an RV12?
Like,
Well, I'm building one. If you want it, I'll charge you a premium. You can have it.
Because you're building it.
I've got an RV12 actually at the moment. And you know, yes, I can get you one. I can get you one. And there's ways that broker, because, you know, the thing is with people spend a lot of time researching what aeroplane they want, but, you know, people have got jobs, they've got lives, they've got families. This is what I do. I scour the internet internationally and nationally all the time. And I know where the market's at. I know what's available. Mm-hmm. I know what's not available. And so if someone comes to me and says, listen, I want a plane, I'll say, let me take your details and I'll give you a call when something comes up. Likely though, they've tried and failed. So it might take me a couple of months to get one.
Yeah, to make
happy with that usually. Yeah.
When you're sitting there scouring the internet and you've got those connections and those contacts, do you ever see anything there where you look at it and you go, I reckon I could pick that up for myself?
Look, I run by a few ethical standards and a few self-imposed ethics, I suppose. There's no industry. Actually, that's an interesting point. There's no industry body governing brokering of aircraft, but I take the general principles that I'm not in it for myself in terms of picking up bargains and flogging them or flipping them, as they say.
That's not what you do. That's not part
of it. That's not what I do. No. I work on behalf of my clients and I try and get them the best deal possible.
Yeah, it's almost like the real estate agent seeing the unbelievable property deal and then swooping in and getting it. They just don't have the time or the resource to do that either.
No, and it's not the business that they're in. I mean, you know, if I wanted to do that, I'd probably do it, but I don't.
Yeah, interesting. So what is it that you're selling the most of? I'm interested to know. What's the favorite thing out there in the marketplace that you're seeing through your business?
Light experimental aircraft that can do it all. That sounds really weird, doesn't it? But it's
broad.
Yeah, it's very broad. So, you know, I think the biggest question I need answered when someone comes to me is, what are you looking for? Because the biggest issue that people have when they're buying an aeroplane is understanding themselves what they actually want, believe it or not. We think we know what we want, but until you speak to someone like me and I ask some, you know, just genuine questions around, well, what do you want it to do? You usually get, well, I want it to be fast. I want it to be economical. I want it to do aerobatics and I want it to be able to put my surfboard in the back. And ostensibly that sounds fabulous, but there isn't an aeroplane that does all that. Well, there's a couple I can think of, but you have to pay a premium for them. So what we need to do is just ascertain exactly what you want the aeroplane to do. Once we've worked that out, there's usually only three or four types that will do that. And then we can narrow it down. So usually they're my first questions. Well, what do you need? I know you want a X, but you also mentioned aerobatics and touring. It only does one of those things.
But which one's more to you?
Yeah, what's more important? And then we drill down, and it's a really interesting conversation. I have it with pretty much every buyer. But once we determine what we want, it's very easy. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, well, let's get you something that suits your budget. And, you know, they're always out there. It's just a matter of finding them. Sometimes that means going, you know, to the States or the UK or New Zealand and finding one that's a good example and getting it ferried over.
Yeah, makes sense. And tell me about that international side of things. As I was doing a little bit of research for this interview, one of the things that popped in my head was when you're looking to buy an aeroplane or you're looking to sell something and you're listing it on these websites and you're looking at the websites to try and buy one, do you have much international inquiry at all?
Funnily enough, we do. The inquiry is not the issue. The difficulty is doing business globally, although it's much easier nowadays with internet, you know, communications. It's just easy. But there's still a trust issue for some reason. And I get it. It's you're buying a, you know, $80,000, $100,000 aircraft. So people will inquire. They'll want all the documentation, which is fair enough. They want photos, which is fair enough. But it's getting them across the line in terms of what, making that final jump. You know, I will make the commitment to give you $100,000 if you promise contractually to send me an aircraft in a container. And it's a very hard one for people to get around mentally.
Is that because they're buying it sight unseen?
Yeah. But the strange thing is, Rob, is that the majority of my aircraft, the aircraft sales that I make within Australia, so Australia to Australia, are bought sight unseen.
But it's not an issue.
It's not an issue, right? So 60%, I would say, maybe 55, 60%. Look, you've given me the photos. You've given me all the details I need. It looks good. Here's my money. And then we organise, you know, the contracts and we organise delivery. So it's sort of, it's still a bit of a strange one for me that international sales are so much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Is that a market you're looking to expand in?
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm actually in final negotiations with a business in the US who've expressed interest in taking the sport aircraft sales model, which has proven successful in Australia, and taking it to the US market and Canada. So we're actually franchising the model.
Congratulations, man. Thank you very much. Fabulous. Fabulous news. There you go. You announced it publicly. It's out there now. So well done. How does that feel for you? Because that's a relatively new business for you. And then here you are kind of going over there and ruling the world. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's fabulous. So you make something up on the beach in St. Kilda one day and
it's got to start somewhere, right? What better place?
Right. Yeah. Well, what better place? It was a beautiful day too. I remember it. I'll never forget. And there I was. And then I, you know, registered the domain name, but I've got a few secrets up my sleeve in terms of getting the brand out there because I've got a bit of experience in that field. And look, someone just came along and said, I've seen what you do. I really like it. Yeah. It was a bit of a proud moment. It'd be nice to sign those contracts and see it for real. Yeah. But, I mean, the market in the US is so much more buoyant than in Australia, largely due to the regulations. There's so much, when I say lax, you know what I mean? It's much easier to fly recreationally in the US. So the EAA and the FAA have done a fabulous job in sort of getting a framework where people feel comfortable, they feel safe, the public feels safe, and people can fly freely. So the market's kind of buoyant over there, and that's why they're doing a lot of flight training and stuff in the US, and Australia's sort of lagging behind, sadly, but I think it'll be very good for our business, yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, we look forward to seeing that scale out and roll out for you. Maybe we can revisit that on a podcast down the track as you get a little bit more success and look talk about that it. And celebrate that with you. You know, it's an Australian success story in aviation. It's great.
Sure. There's not many of them right now.
there's a few. There's more than you realise, actually. I talked to quite a few people. The sentiment as I go around and talk to people in the industry as a podcaster is really positive. On that note, what would you say the sentiment of the industry is at the moment? Is it positive? You said sales were a little bit kind of depressed and down, but would you say market sentiment is feeling good? Is it optimistic?
Federal politics hasn't helped.
Federal politics doesn't help anything.
No. Well, yes.
Especially aviation, maybe, right? I don't know. I can't comment.
The constant change of government doesn't help. But look, aside from that, there's bigger issues at play. I think, and, you know, I don't want to sound negative. I've got to be very careful here because I love recreational aviation. I like the premise of RAOs. I love what they're trying to do. But the regulator in CASA and the government need to come together and have a good hard look at themselves because, and it's the hardest thing in the world for a government body to do is to look at themselves and say, where are we going with this? Are we only focused on safety, which is what the Civil Aviation Safety Authority does? Mm-hmm. Or do we really need to legislate and look at how we have sustainability in the industry? So back to your question, I believe the Australian market is becoming depressed at the moment, partially due to the economics, partially due to the politics. I mean, you know, unrelated economic politics, but largely due to an inability for the regulator to see that the word sustainability and freedom to fly needs to sit hand in hand with safety. And for the last few years, they haven't. And we're reaping the sad and sorry sort of negatives of that at the moment.
Can you give me an example, like a specific example of how that regulation is impacting the industry?
Sure. I'll give the listeners a really easy example. And it came out in the Senate Regional and Rural Affairs Transport Committee hearing recently, where, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but you're welcome to go and have a look at it. I encourage people to do that. The chairman of that committee actually made a very good observation or asked a question. If I look in the sky and I see two aircraft flying on the same route and they look like the same type of aeroplane, they're light aeroplanes, maybe two-seaters or four-seaters, let's call it a two-seater, and one's blue and one's red. In other words, let's say one is VH registered and one is RAOs registered. Can I be sure that the pilot training for aircraft one and aircraft two are the same? And can I be sure that the medical standards that require one of those pilots to fly are the same as the other? And the simple answer although I'm paraphrasing here, from CASA was, in short, Chairman, the answer is no. You can't be sure because, in fact, the answer is one pilot has a higher standard of medical requirement and the other pilot doesn't. In fact, one pilot signs a form and says, yeah, I'm fit. And the other pilot has to go through a rigorous class one or class two medical examination. So we have this discrepancy between what RAOs pilots were allowed to do and what CASA or VH, general aviation pilots, were allowed to do. It's causing a lot of division in the industry. And, you know, that has knock-on effects. And you asked me the question, well, can you give me an example? That's one example that's knocked on to my business because people are confused. People don't know whether they're going RAOs or GA or whether they're going to be able to fly indeed. So there's a lot of people saying, oh, geez, my eyesight's deteriorating. I think I'm just going to go RAOs. Well, that's not the model that's supposed to happen. CASA is supposed to regulate one industry, surely. And so people are just getting confused and they're saying, a lot of them are saying, to hell with it. I used to fly 20 years ago and I'm not doing it anymore. And actually, I've come back into the industry after 20 years and I'm confused. I'm confused and I'm in the industry. Dare I say, I think CASA are confused. I think the senators were confused at the recent inquiry or the committee hearing rather. And I think RAOs might be confused as well. Certainly the members are. So we need some stability. Growth comes from a lot of things, including stability. If you get legislative framework that's stable, people will say, have confidence in the system.
And so how would you draw a comparison between last year, 2017 and 2018? Has that impacted your business? I mean, is it impacting the business or is it just a different way of people communicating with you and asking different questions?
There's uncertainty. People don't know the rules. I mean, you know, I've got a friend.
And that's what impacts it, right?
Sure. It's the uncertainty. You know, for me, if you bring back the certainty and the consistency across the industry, then you'll have a healthy industry. People will say, you know, a 16-year-old like I was in the 90s will say, Dad, I want to learn to fly. I want to be a pilot. And Dad won't go, gee, son, I'm okay, but where do we start? What do we do? And then someone says, oh, be a recreational pilot. And the other guy goes, no, be a GA pilot. And everyone's scratching their heads. You know, we've got to have certainty. Compared to last year, less certain.
What do you think 2019 holds for us?
We're at a crossroads, Rob. We're at a crossroads. We really, really are. And I don't want to put too fine a point on it. This is legislatively, we need change. We need change. And I hope, you know, some CASA officials and some people in RAOs are listening to what I have to say because I'm in the industry. I've got experience. I know what's going on. We need change. I'm optimistic because I get up in the morning and I always look to the future and I'm always happy about it. But will people buy aeroplanes? Of course they will. Mm-hmm. You know, will my business do well? Yes, of course it will. But I prefer if everyone just got together in the industry rather than dividing it and give some certainty back to people and the general public. The general public do not want a divided aviation industry all fighting amongst each other. They want safety and sustainability. And by the way, if I may say, that breeds young people to learn to fly so that they can fly the Qantas planes and the Virgin planes and the Rex planes that we all get on every day and we rely on for our fruit and vegetables and our, you know, our RPT and commercial passenger services. We don't want an industry where we have to import all our pilots because no one wants to fly in Australia. Well, certainly I don't. It's not a thing about, you know, it's not sort of saying, well, international pilots are worse or better. It's about, well, hang on, we're a confident modern economy, surely. We should be able to train our own people. And at the moment, it's not happening.
So what do you think the solution, here we are at the crossroads as you describe it, what would you, you know, what's your ideal circumstance? Is it legislative change? Is it the industry coming together as a collective and understanding that there is challenges there that need to be resolved? What do you think the solution is?
It's all those things, Rob, but my opinion, if one was to ask me, I think the most powerful way to change things is for a really big group of people to realise that there's a problem. And stop putting it under the carpet. And I mean RAOs, and I mean people in GA as well, like the SAAA and, you know, and AOPA. And coming together, that's the first thing. The second thing is we need to get the senators and the politicians to understand, because CASA's not going to tell them. CASA's just going to sit there and say, we're doing a great job. Look at the safety numbers. Well, I tell you what CASA want. They want no one to fly, because that's the safest approach, isn't it, surely?
Now, around everybody.
Obviously, I'm exaggerating a little bit.
Of course.
But look, yes, legislative change. We need lobbying. We need AOPA to continue the really good work they're doing. The SAAA is doing a fabulous job. And we need to all come together. And we need RAOs to come to their senses and say, hey, guys, look, you know, we disagree on some things, but we're all part of the same industry. And then we need to all go to Canberra, so to speak, and lobby and say, look, we need security. We need to attract people back to the aviation industry, which is, let's be honest, failing. And then the politicians will say, all right, what do you want us to do? And then they'll change the legislation, and then CASA has to follow. That's my opinion, the way it has to go.
Well, it sounds like there's some leadership that's needed there, mate, and maybe it's time for Nicholas to level up and step up. You know, it's one thing to have an opinion. It's another thing to get out there and lead, and I'll put it out there publicly. And you know what I mean? Like it takes people to commit to things and to get out there and lead to do that.
Yeah, that's right. We need a movement. A movement doesn't start. Movement starts with one or two people.
It does.
And then it just grows. And look, I mean, you know, if we want to start a movement, we're passionate about it, let's do it now. And I'm calling everyone who believes in what I just said to contact me or to call AOPA or to become a member or, you know, just be active, you know. If we love something enough, we want to protect it, well, let's be active.
I think that's the key there as well, and that's a really nice way to describe that is to be active. All right, Nicholas, I want to move off that and talk about something really super cool that you've got, and you mentioned it earlier there at the top of our interview, Aero Momentum Aircraft Engines.
Oh, yeah.
Is it a competitor to?
To, well, you know, oh, dare I say it, Rotax, and Rotax is a fantastic motor. Don't get me wrong.
Great product, yep.
Great product. Beautifully made, very reliable. Look, we've got a bit of a shift, right? And we've got a big shift. We've got a shift from the 1950s technology motors, right? Horizontally opposed, fuel guzzling, magneto driven things that we thought
were technology in my 20-year-old car, right?
Correct. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, your car is much more sophisticated than anything we're flying at the moment. But we've got to change, right? So people are saying, oh, Continental Lycoming, they served us well. Fabulous motors. I'm going to shift, right? So they're saying, okay, well, what will I put in my experimental aircraft? And I went through the same thing. I said, well, it's got to be a Rotax, doesn't it? Got to be. Mm-hmm. Right? And look, some people would agree with that still. It's got to be a Rotax. Fine. But the whole point around experimental aircraft is that it's got to be affordable. Mm-hmm. And it's got to do what you want it to do.
That's the point, right?
Isn't it, right? So when I started building my RV12, and I'm nearly finished, I didn't have any cash. I had a dream. I said, well, this is going to cost me $100,000, but I don't know how I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of worked it out as I went along that I can do it in small bits. But then the biggest bit was going to be the motor. Mm-hmm. Financially, the biggest commitment. So, yeah, Aero Momentum was started on the premise that, you know, you want something to cost about 60% the cost of, say, a Rotax, which is where we're sitting in the market. And we need it to be reliable, ultra reliable. So we've developed in the States, a guy called Mark Kettering has developed, he's an aerospace engineer, developed a Suzuki block, basically a Suzuki Swift engine. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of done a few tweaks and it's electronically fuel injected. And we're really hoping that people will consider it in their new experimental aircraft. And look, we're doing well so far.
It seems considerably less, 60% less. That's massive.
Well, 60% of the cost, so about 40% less. So, so in real terms, we can land one of these motors for any aircraft, really, an experimental aircraft, and have it landed at your door for 6/10 of the cost that it would be for the same horsepower in a Rotax. And really, I think the market's going to say thumbs up to that, because at the end of the day, we've got commitments financially, and the cost of living in Australia is going up. Mm-hmm. So people are looking at ways to say, well, let's do the same thing, but do it a bit cheaper.
So I'm interested to hear your thought process about it then, because you were like Rotax all the way. That's what it has to be. And then suddenly you come across this. What was it that shifted your thinking? Was it the actual cost of it, the reliability of it? Or is it a combination of things? Was there one thing that really stood out to you?
Can I be really honest? First thing, it looked really good. Like, if you get on the website and have a look at this thing, it's like, it's really quite a aesthetically pleasing engine. But the second thing was, once I was convinced to look a little further, was reliability. I mean, this thing's been tested in airboats. I mean, you know, I don't know if your listeners are aware, Suzuki has probably one of the best reputations for reliability. And basically, it's a Suzuki engine with Suzuki parts that are readily available, but it's been adapted for airboats. It's done thousands of hours in trikes. It's now doing a lot of hours in Sea Ray aircraft and amphibious types. Mm-hmm. So, look, I was very skeptical at first, and then I did some research and said, oh, geez, these things have been flogged, you know, without the requirements that we have in maintenance. You know, I mean, geez, I didn't check my oil when I went driving last, did you?
No.
No. We really take care of our motors. And so if you take a really, really robust motor and you apply some aviation principles around maintenance, you've got yourself a pretty robust platform for an experimental aircraft.
And so you've got one of these coming in for your RV12 and you set up the business as well here in Australia as the distributor for it. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, we've got the Australia-New Zealand distributor, exclusive distribution.
How are the sales tracking for you?
Well, we've only been going 3 months and we've sold three engines. Well, no, we've sold three engines. So, I mean, you know, 3 months, three engines and hardly any marketing. Now we're starting to get out there and put the brand out there. So we've got a lot of interest, you know. And of course, these things are slow because it's taken me 2.5 years to get to the stage that I'm at with my motor.
You're ready to buy an engine for your plane.
That's right. So people don't just ring up and say, hey, I'd like a motor. When can you get it to me? Next week. Okay, fine. Mm. Sort of. I'm building an aeroplane. I'm considering a Rotax or a Lycoming or a Viking or a Jabiru. Mm-hmm. But I've heard about you. Tell me more. And then 6 months later, they might come back to you and say, here's my deposit. You know, when can you get one to me? And that's so it's a long-term project. We're in it for the long term. And as Rotax was when they came into Australia, and we're looking forward to giving a really good level of customer service.
Fantastic. Well, 1 a month so far is a pretty good result to kick it all off. What's on the horizon with that? Is there a whole plan to launch? Are you going to saturate the market? What are you doing?
I know ads. Okay. Well, I'll talk to you later. But no, we've put a bit of advertising out there. It's look, we don't have unlimited resources, so we're going slow. I think word of mouth is a really good one, mm-hmm. isn't it? So we want to start allowing people to understand how the motors are operating in their aircraft, in other people's aircraft, and we'll get some data out to the market. And I think the market will be delighted with what we're providing. Your question was, how am I going to, let's say if you come to Avalon, you'll see.
Nice.
So
well, we'll Avalon 2. There at Avalon. So let's reconnect there and maybe we can talk about those engines and do a little podcast while we're down there as well.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Yeah. Look, we'll be down there. We'll have some motors there. People touch them, feel them, look at them, and we'll be there to answer any questions you might have. So.
Fantastic. All right, Nicholas, that will just about wraps it up for the show today. Any parting shots before we wrap this one up, mate?
No, look, I'm positive. I love flying. I love aviation. I love general aviation and recreational flying. And let it continue. But we just need some changes. So let's all get together, change a few things, tweak a few things, and let's keep our freedom to fly in Australia. And come and see me if you want to buy an aeroplane.
All right. If they do want to connect with you and buy an aeroplane, where's the best place to do that?
Sportaircraftsales.com.au. sportaircraftsales.com.au and connect. And even if you're not looking at something right now, let's have a chat about it. And even if you just want to have a chat about the industry, agree or disagree with my views, I'm very happy to talk.
Sounds great. Well, I'll make sure that those links are included to the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for coming on the show, Nick. We look forward to seeing you down at Avalon in a couple of months, mate, and it's bye for now.
Look forward to it, Rob. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I'm here with Michael Linke from RA Oz. G'day, Michael. It's great to have you on the Australian Aviation Podcast, mate.
It's great to be on the podcast. Really looking forward to a great chat.
All right. Before we go into the year that was, my gosh, it flashed past in a really quick time for me this year, 2018. I just want to introduce you to the audience and for the people that don't know you, what's your proper job title? You're the CEO of RA Oz.
I am indeed Chief Executive Officer of Recreational Aviation Australia. We get tied up in all these acronyms and people wonder what they are sometimes. So yeah, traditional Chief Executive role, running Recreational Aviation Australia, a national aviation body that looks after licensing and registration of aviators and aircraft alike.
Well, tell us a little bit about you before we get into all of those acronyms and all that aviation stuff. What's your background in aviation?
I don't have a strong background in aviation at all, and I think that was one of the attractions that RAL's wanted 5 years ago, four and a half to 5 years ago. I started in 2014, halfway through 2014, and the organisation had been through some turmoil time. And I think the board wanted a fresh perspective, a fresh set of eyes on an organisation in the aviation sector, but not necessarily from an aviator. And that's how I came to the role. I was in the market for a new job. I'd spent 8 years at RSPCA as the chief executive. I've run major arms of charities, a blindness charity, Vision Australia. And I've got a long career in the public service, 15, 16 years in the Australian Taxation Office with, degrees and I suppose credentials in the tax law space and the marketing space more than aviation. So when this opportunity came along, we had a really frank conversation with the board and the panel that was recruiting me, saying, well, look, I don't have any aviation experience. What I can bring to the role, though, is a structured, strategic business viewpoint, because we were losing money, we were losing members, we were having lots of accidents. There were processing delays. There were difficulties in getting information out to members and communication. So we weren't struggling in the aviation space. What we were struggling in is the business space.
Right.
So the board said, let's get a business person in, somebody that understands business processes, strategy, and let's engage in that space. So that's how I came to be. And then I surrounded myself with expert aviators, and I think that's the best way to get the job done. So people like Leah Vesic, who you've spoken to, command instrument rating person. We've got Jared Smith with us, who's a multi-engine rated instructor as well. Jill Bailey, who's had, 30, 40 years behind in a cockpit, and Neil Schaefer. So all our senior managers are pilots or instructors and have significant skills, not only piloting, but in engineering, in training, instructing, safety and risk, you name it. So I've got those people around me. And of course, our board is made up of seven members of RALs, all pilots or engineers or risks or lawyers or analysts or strategists, all with those skills. So I'm able to massage and bring those two sets of skills together to make, RALs successful. And I think we've done that in the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, for the folks that are listening, and maybe this is their first podcast in the aviation space, can you tell us a little bit about RAOs and what your actual role is and where you guys actually sit in the aviation market?
Yeah, well, we're one of nine self-administering sport aviation organisations. So CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, has delegated some of the responsibilities of the Civil Aviation Act to a group of organisations to manage different components of that. It allows CASA to focus on the big end of town, and that's where CASA's real focus is, on the Qantas and the Virgins and the really bulk passenger movement safety. The community wants a safe aviation sector, and CASA's responsibility is to provide that. And then below that, we have a number of organisations, and we're one of nine, that deliver a whole range of different types of services in that space. And our specific interest is the recreational space and the flight training space, in terms of licensing pilots and training pilots to get their basic license and their first recreational license, and also looking after the registration of light sport and ultralight aircraft up to 600 kilos in weight with two people on board. So a very specific component of the market, but a reasonably large one. People will think that, how many pilots can you have flying, sub 600 kilo aircraft? We've got about 10,000 pilots and about 3,500 aircraft on the register that we're responsible for. So it's quite significant. When you look at the macro size of our business, we account for about 7% of all flying activity undertaken in Australia. So it's a reasonably large chunk of it, but it's a fairly specific set of that. We don't do charter. We don't do commercial operations. It's all recreational. It's all single-person operations or single-person and a single passenger, but largely in the training space. So people start out, get their license, learn to fly, and then either continue to fly recreational, which most of our members will do. They'll just, buy a plane or hire a plane and fly recreationally as we pursue hundreds of different recreational activities. Flying is one of those.
Yeah.
And other people then pursue a career. They see it as a career opportunity. So they get the recreational license. They then move on to a higher graded license through the CASA system, either a commercial license, a private pilot's license. They can then go into charter and commercial work when they get their commercial license. Or they then go on into the big heavy aircraft and get regular passenger transport licenses, so an RPT license or an ATPL, an air traffic transport license. in that space and start flying, you know, Sydney to LA or Sydney to Heathrow or Melbourne to Singapore, that type of stuff. So it's a mixed bag we offer. And that's what we try to say to people, that we're one of the entry points into aviation. The other sport organizations, the Hang Gliding Federation, the Sport Aircraft Association, places like that, offer people different opportunities to get into aviation in different space. So there's 9 or 10 entry points that you can, I suppose, pursue to get into aviation. You've just got to find the flavor that suits you. It's like going into an ice cream shop. Mm-hmm. Well, do I want chocolate? Do I want vanilla? Do I want matcha? What do I want? And we've got this really great sector in Australia with these 9 groups that offer 9 different choices of getting into aviation. And we're one of those 9. And we try and encourage and diversify and get people moving between each of the organizations so that we can build and grow aviation.
Very nice. Nicely said, and great clear explanation as well. So if I was somebody new to aviation, if I was a school leaver and I was thinking about getting into it, how is RAOs different to the other pathways that are in there? Obviously, that's a feeder into something a little bit bigger in GA and moving up into CPL and ATP, as you mentioned. What's the difference in starting with you guys as in starting with GA or a VH registered aeroplane, so to speak?
Yeah, well, one of the key differences is the cost. It's a lot more affordable to get into an RAL's registered aircraft because they're newer aircraft, they're cheaper to operate. So their running time, their cost per hour to operate is cheaper. So the outcome to get your license is a lot cheaper. Now, there's some restrictions on that license. There's no night flying. There's no instrument rating. There's no bulk passenger carrying capacity with that. So there are some limitations. And that's why we say that we're a stepping stone. So you tap into RAL's first, you might get your RAL's license. 15, 20, 25 hours in the cockpit. That will then get you that license. You then add on components of that, get your private license, which then lets you get into controlled airspace and land at some controlled airfields, carry more passengers. You then get your commercial space and you start flying bigger aircraft. You then might go for a twin engine endorsement to then move into the twins and then move into the major airlines. So there's those opportunities. So our biggest point of difference initially is the cost. The second point is the availability and accessibility. There's 165 schools around Australia. So everywhere that you think of flying or going in Australia, every state and territory, you're probably flying an RAL school. But the main driver is that cost.
Very nice. Nicely said. And nice and clear as well to explain. So is it a good point of entry for somebody that's not quite sure? Just go out, trial instructional flight, do a couple of lessons, get it under your belt. Is that a really good way to start it off?
Yeah, I think it's a great way. It's as I said, it's accessible. It's inexpensive. You do a trial instructional flight in a little plane. And one of the key things is a lot of the planes that we use are very modern. Kids mm-hmm. today got their iPads, got their iPhones. They're used to that screen, that glass screen technology. And it's not a criticism of some of the beautiful 1950s and 1960s aircraft that are out there still as trained as your Cessnas and things like that. But a lot of the aircraft that RALs offer, you know, 8 years old, 6 years old, 5 years old. One of our schools is buying, you know, new aircraft almost every month. So you're going to get into an aircraft that is very new, has a lot of new features and facilities in terms of technology in it, so that you're used to that type of technology as a young person getting into it. You're not going to get into an aircraft with the so-called steam gauges that were designed 40 or 50 years ago. And I assimilate it to learning to drive a car. If you drive a car, people don't learn to drive cars in FJ Holden's today. They learn to drive, you know, modern cars with modern ABS braking in it, airbags, all that type of stuff. So that's one of the advantages. But you then progress and you move into heavier aircraft and then go into a Cessna or a Piper or a Bonanza as you build your skills into those aircraft that are reliable, safe, really well built, really great aircraft, but they're more expensive to run and they're a little bit different to the RAL's aircraft. But it's a pathway. It's horses for courses and where you want to go with your career. Do you just want to fly a little two-seater around that weighs 400, 300 kilos to suit your recreational needs because you're out in the country area and you want to visit your friends a couple of hours away from you? It's easier to fly than drive. Get something that's $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth, $10,000 investment to get your license and away you go. So reasonably inexpensive to get into. So that's one of the main attractions, I think, that people are starting to really flock to RALs.
Yeah, you put it really eloquently and very diplomatically as well, I have to say. You know, some of the aeroplanes that I learned to fly on were, you know, they were literally from the 1950s and you get in them, there's nothing wrong with them, you know what I mean? Like that, they fly just fine.
But beautiful aircraft.
Yeah, but they're old. They're old airframes and they kind of smell old and they feel old. And when you swap into something that's a little bit newer, then it's got a bit more grunt about it and it's a bit nicer on the inside, it does definitely make all the difference. And I could see what the attraction would be in an RA aeroplane as you're learning to fly like that as well. And it's certainly a great way to get into aviation and enjoy the recreational aspect of it. I was lucky enough to go out flying yesterday. It was a beautiful day here in Sydney, just absolutely stunning weather. The sky was smooth as glass. There was hardly any turbulence. And we were just staring around the northern beaches and down into Victor One and out over to Mittagong and stuff. And it was just fun to be nowhere and to be everywhere all at the same time. And I think that's missing a little bit from aviation in Australia. So anything that you guys can do to promote that, I'm all for that. That's for sure. That's the passion behind it for me.
And that's what we're trying to do, really getting that passion back and understanding the audience. You know, the Australia has changed. The community has changed. The desires for flying has changed. We're much more disposable society now. People like you look at all the new houses and new apartments getting built. People are changing TVs over more often. Their cars are getting changed more often. So what one thing we're really trying to say to the whole sector and demonstrate with that through our schools is that people want new, people want bright, shiny. And if there is an opportunity for that and we can provide that, well, why not provide it? Why not offer that? And we've got a number of schools that are doing that. And it's even the presentation of hangar space and presentation of training rooms. You know, people want to go into, you know, not a dark, dingy hangar that's got tools and mess everywhere. They want a nice, bright lit training room. You know, I was down at one of our new training centres at Moorabbin, and the beautiful, well lit training rooms, beautiful whiteboards, technology in there. So you're going in and you really understand that you're going to get a really good, positive learning experience from that school. And it creates confidence in the parents who are bringing their kids in, whether it's a son or daughter that they're bringing in to learn, 14, 15-year-old. The parents have confidence in a quality product. And if you start that quality from that point in time, it's likely that the perception is that the aircraft you're going to fly in is going to be a quality aircraft. The instructing that you're going to get is quality instructing. And the overall experience is going to be positive. And that's what we're trying to say to the sector, that we need this positive experience to encourage people to get into the sector. Because it's a great sector. There's so much magic in this sector. You know, Victor One is one of the most beautiful routes in the world. It's phenomenal to fly that. And I love getting out to, you know, our country areas. We go to Narromine, we get out to Tomorrow. I was at Tomorrow 3 or 4 weeks ago, did some flying out there with some of the staff, getting down to Holbrook, you know, the birthplace of R.A. Oz really at Holbrook, and seeing some of the airframes down there and the passion. And it's, I'm really trying to capture that passion and get that out into the community and out into the sector to get more and more people involved.
Yeah, I love the way you describe how there's different entry points to it as well, because it's, you know, there's options out there for people, and consumers need choice. And it sounds like RA Oz is one of those choices and a really natural one. Michael, tell me, how long have you been with the company again? I think you mentioned 4 years there.
Yeah, four and a half years at Christmas. Yeah, so 5 years next July.
Okay, awesome. Well, will you be well placed to answer the next question, because this is the 2018, the year that was, the year in review. How is RA Oz tracking as a business now, this year, compared to the same time last year? Are you seeing some good growth? Are you on a nice trajectory there?
Well, we are indeed. There's three things that I measure that I use as my key metrics. And there's so many metrics that you can use in a business. You've got to focus on three key things. And the three things I focus on are our membership growth and aircraft growth. I tie those two together. Our financial stability and our financial sustainability to make sure that we continue to provide members with the services. And our safety record, because it's important that, you know, you can go out and fly hundreds of thousands of hours and train millions of people. But if you're not safe, well, then people aren't going to continue to come back. So those three things are all in the green. I like to say our dials are in the green compared to last year. So we've had a 3% membership growth in the last 12 months. That's on top of 8% growth last year. So we've had 11% growth in 2 years. Our aircraft fleet has grown 3% this year. We've turned a profit. We've had about $190,000 surplus this year, which is fantastic. And all those funds just get completely reinvested back into members. You know, we're not a profit company. We're not for profit. So the directors can't take any money. I can't take any money out of that. That goes 100% back into member services and member development. And our third metric is our safety record. We've had 3 fatalities in the last 12 months. 4 or 5 years ago, we're averaging 10, 12 fatalities a year. So I think it's difficult to talk about, but I think it's an important thing to talk about, that, you know, 200, 300,000 flying hours a year and 2 to 3 fatalities a year now. Our safety record has really improved, and we're really focused on making ourselves genuine safety player in the aviation space and sharing that message with other organisations and other groups. So looking at the last 12 months, those three things are all positive for me. The board's satisfied with them. Our staff here are satisfied with them, and our members are satisfied. We did a members survey in April this year, and the feedback we're getting from members is that we're going in the right direction. We don't get everything right. And I think you'd be a fool to say we've got it 100% right. I think when we get it 100% right, it's time to turn off the lights and go home.
Yeah.
That's why you come to work every day, to keep improving. And I want growth next year, and I want more improvement next year, and I want our safety record to be better next year. And I think if we rest on our laurels, well, then we're doing the wrong thing by our members. But I'm always striving and working with our staff to make next year better than this year. This year was better than last year, so the trajectory is looking pretty good for us.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. And as I go around and talk to different people in the aviation space from all different sectors, I was talking to a fellow the other day in the microlight space, and his business was absolutely booming.
Yeah.
His growth trajectories were really strong as well. And I've spoken to some other people in aircraft sales, which is doing really well at the same time as well. So the outlook, in my view, is very, very positive for aviation. And that, I guess that's my anecdote a little bit as the kind of the host of the Australian Aviation Podcast. I've spoken to a couple of airport operators as well, and the numbers for them are coming back. Nowhere near pre-2008 levels, of course, but there's a number of movements are certainly increasing and coming back as well. So it seems like it's on the right path, and it's doing what everybody in the industry wants it to do. I wanted to ask you there on those three KPIs that you were mentioning, that you've got good growth for your members, you've got good revenue and a nice surplus in there as well. But that safety record is definitely something that's difficult to talk about. What do you think it is that has improved the safety record? Are the standards that you guys have across instructors, or is it the people that are within RAOs have just got a higher standard for themselves? What do you think it is? Is that one thing or multiple?
It's multiple things. The first thing is the focus on it. 5 years ago, we didn't talk about it. Nobody talked about safety. Nobody talked about fatal accidents. We didn't, you know, people, it was something, you know,
taboo.
People weren't willing, yeah, taboo topic. And when I started, I said, well, why don't we send out newsletters to members saying that we've had a fatal accident? Let's tell them what's going on. Let's open that conversation. And we started with, you know, a conversation around safety, was a key thing in 2014. So I think that was the catalyst for that. We started openly talking about it. And then members realized that, because people don't go out. You don't get up in the morning, jump in your airplane and go, oh, I'm going to have a controlled collision with terrain today. I'm going to run out of fuel today. You know, everybody gets in the aircraft with good intentions to take off and to land. You know, so landings and takeoffs should be equal. And that's what we started to say to people. Let's try and get equity between like takeoffs and landings. So let's talk about that. I can't sit on your shoulder when you're in the cockpit, so I can't do anything about that. So safety used to be an input. We tried to tell people about safety. You must be safe. You've got to do this. You've got to do this. And in the last couple of years, we've shifted that. So safety is the output. So in achieving that output, what are the things that we can do that help people get the safest outcome possible? It's providing resources to our schools. It's having that conversation. It's working with schools in the safety space. It's creating a safety management system. It was creating a robust reporting mechanism, saying to members, if you report to us that you've had a problem, we're not going to throw you out. We're not going to take your pilot certificate off you and kick you out of ROLs. We're going to sit down and have a conversation. Why did you have a runway loss of control? What went wrong? Mm-hmm. And we discovered that lots of people were having the same types of issues. So the more we talked about it, the more we're able to use it as an education resource. So it's almost a circular process. Tell us about the problems that you're having. We then learn the problems that you're having. We create resources to go into schools to talk about those problems that we have, so the next generation of people don't have the same problems. And we're seeing an overall reduction in those type of incidents and accidents because people are telling us, what are the problems they're having? And once you have that awareness, you can then educate other people. And I say to our members, if you have an accident and you don't tell me about it, you're stealing knowledge and learning from 10,000 other members. It's important that you tell us about it, because then we can do something about it. We can fix it. If I don't know, I can't fix it. And we try and have that real honest conversation with members. And we've seen a significant uptake in the number of members reporting incidents. You know, we've been able to fix taxiways and fix runways because we've had multiple incidences at the same airports where we've had prop strikes. You know, no fault of the pilot, no fault of the aircraft. There's something else is wrong. You know, and we've been able to really facilitate that change and facilitate improvements across the board. So I think all those things combined has allowed us to improve that safety record.
Yeah, and that can only be a good thing for the community as well, to come together in any way, shape or form to share those learnings and those lessons. I think the folks that put out the magazine, the government magazine that comes out, Flight Safety.
Oh, yeah.
They do a really good job.
Yeah.
In highlighting stories and accidents. And I know as a private pilot that I read that mag. I remember I used to get in a hard copy of that and sitting down and reading that cover to cover as it came in the mail. It's an electronic version of it now these days, but there was a lot of lessons always to be learnt in that. And I never thought that it was such a big deal that people had an accident in a little Cessna or something went on, because the lessons that you learnt from that, it actually drove me to want to know more about those,
exactly,
read more about those incidents. And in doing that as a low-time pilot, I think that can only make me more aware of the potential things that can go wrong, and then makes me a little bit safer as well, I think.
Well, it does. It creates that awareness. Our chairman, Michael Monk, he wrote two articles for Flight Safety. He had two incidents, and he wrote about it. And he's saying to members, hey, I'm the chairman of this organization, chairman of a 10,000-person organization. I'm not infallible. I've had incidents, mm-hmm, and I'm happy to write about them. I'm happy to publish them and tell people that I've had them. So we've really created that awareness that it's okay for the chairman to say it. It's okay for our members to say it. Nothing happened to him. He's still chairman, you know. So tell us about those incidents and then share those stories. People like you, people like our 10,000 members, then read them, learn about them, understand, and can improve their safety. Sometimes you've got to do 15 things in the cockpit, you know, and it's that 15th thing that causes you to have an incident. If you're aware of the other 14 things and what that 15th thing is, you might be able to stop it from happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that old Swiss cheese model of all the things that line up that cause an issue. We were going flying once with our chairman, Mick. It was here in Canberra in July, freezing cold, -7. We hired one of the Cessnas from the local aero club here, and he had a series of problems. He got up in the morning, his car didn't start properly. He got to the airport, the batteries in the lock safe had run out. He had to go to a service station, get new batteries so he could open the safe to get the keys out of the aircraft. My taxi was late getting me to the airport. When we tried to start the plane, it didn't start the first time. Then we flooded the battery. And in the end, we looked at each other and said, we're not flying today. Too many things have gone wrong that morning to go where we needed to go. And we cancelled our meetings and we went a week later. Mm-hmm. And you just need to understand sometimes the world is saying to you, don't fly today. And I think that day it was telling us, don't fly. And others might have pushed on and said, well, let's push on. Let's, you know, change the battery out. And by the time you change the battery out, it's another hour gone. You then get their itis. You've got to get to your meeting. You're rushing. So you might not do your flight, your pre-check properly. You might not listen to your radio calls in the runway taking off from an RPT airport here in Canberra. Who knows what might go wrong? And we made the call that, you know, don't go that day. So I think the more pilots or the more people that make those decisions about that fitness to fly, is what we call it here. It's not just you, it's your aircraft, it's the circumstance around you. Are all these things fit to fly at that instant in time? They might be fit yesterday, they might have been fit a week ago, they might be fit next week, but at this moment today when you're about to fly, are all the things lined up that you're fit to fly? And if you are fit to fly, then by all means go and enjoy that flight. But if something's out, maybe reconsider.
Yeah, those human factors are so unbelievably important, aren't they? And I think virtually everybody that's ever had a pilot's license and being flying has experienced what you just described. At some point along the line, whether that was in training or you were going somewhere or something like that was happening. Yesterday, when we had nowhere to actually particularly be other than in the sky, tearing a hole in it because it was a beautiful blue sky day, we really took our time on the front end, you know, to take the airplane out of the hangar, to fill it up with fuel, kind of got ourselves ready.
Exactly.
And, you know, it wasn't that we were really methodical in getting ready. We just kind of took our time because there was no rush. And I really felt settled when we got right out, ready to go, lining up, getting a clearance and then off we go. It was really kind of like, well, yeah, I've just got absolutely nothing else to worry about or think about. And I think that was part of the enjoyment of the experience.
Yeah.
Because it was relaxed.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect day to fly. You know, I've had three or four, you know, minor issues. I went flying with one of our young pilots once and she left the pitot tube cover on, you know, and I said, why did you do that? She goes, oh, I'm sitting with the chief executive of RALs. And I said, well, if you're nervous about flying with me, let's not go for a flight. And if that's affecting who you are as a person, let's go and have lunch and get to know each other and sit down and wander around. We wandered around for an hour. And then she was perfectly calm. I said, now you're just getting in a plane with no one. You're just getting in a plane with a friend, you know, and we went for a flight and it was perfectly fine after that, you know. So it's just thinking about all the things that can impact you. And if you've got some time, use that extra time to make sure everything's right. But if things aren't going your way, somebody's telling you that maybe today's not the day to fly.
Well, they're beautifully articulated messages you got there. So hopefully the folks at RA Oz and all your members there that are listening into this podcast continue to share all of those lessons learned. So that's all great for the community and hopefully continues to improve that safety trajectory that you've worked so hard to get. So well done there. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Tell me about 2018 and a highlight for you guys.
Highlight this year, it's probably getting the finances under order. You know, we've been under a lot of pressure in the last 3 or 4 years financially, and we've had to make some tough decisions for members, you know, and not always popular. And our members go, well, why have you changed that or why are you charging me more for this? But I think we've structured it this year and we've been able to say to members, we've got the finances right. The promises and the changes that we've made have resulted in this really positive outcome for the organisation. And I think with a strong, healthy organisation, we can then guarantee sustainability for our members going forward. And I think that's the important thing. We've got 10,000 members that rely on us, 165 training schools, 400 or 500 maintainers and engineers out there that rely on the REL's business. So we've got a very serious responsibility, the board and I, to make sure that the organisation is financially stable. So finally getting all the pieces in place to allow us to declare that surplus was probably the highlight for us this year.
Have you got the model right, or is it still being tweaked?
I think we can always improve it. I think we can always tweak it. There are things that I want to do. I want to get our magazine out to more members. I want to get some more digital opportunities to members in terms of the digital space and some more training, and really get some training resources and tap into some of the technologies that are available to us now. Given the diversity of our audience, you know, across the country, some people have good internet, some people have bad internet. So we've got to come up with some really innovative solutions to get some tools to some of our members in really remote locations. So I think we'll continue to tweak it over the next 12 or 18 months. But we're getting pretty close to a really good model of communicating and getting all the information to all our members when they need it. And that's the important thing. When a member wants something, that information is available to them in whatever format they want it, whether it's printed, whether it's digital, electronic, whether it's a telephone call or a personal visit. And we've got a lot of personal visits that we're planning next year as part of our professional development seminar series, which we ran this year, another successful project. So coming up with innovative solutions to get that information to members, I think, is the future of success, or future to our success, looking forward.
Yeah, it's great once you get a business, and I've been there many times in my personal business career, when you get a business to a point where it's just humming along, and then your focus then becomes your customers and your delivery. And in your case, it's your members and your delivery there as well. And it's always a matter of continuing to look forward with kind of one eye on where it is and make sure we don't kind of fall asleep at the wheel, so to speak, and keep moving it forward, right?
Yeah, it's a bit like flying up in a really icy day. You've got one eye on your wings to make sure they're not icing over. And you've got your other eye on your dials to make sure everything's running smoothly.
Right.
And all that type of stuff. So that's a bit where we're at REL's now. I've got that left eye out, just looking at the wing to make sure it doesn't ice over, because everything's going very smoothly. But we're firmly focused on what's ahead of us and what's in front of us into the future, trying to really develop and deliver some real positive benefits to members. Because the last 3 years, we've had to pull back a bit because of the finance of the organisation and some of the membership declines that we had in 2012, 13, 14. We had to, you know, tighten our belts. But now we've done that, and it's time for us to really pay back our members and say thanks to our members for really supporting us through the tough couple of years, and provide them with some great tools and great resources. And part of that professional training that we're offering this year and offering again next year is one of the ways that we're paying back our members.
Well, you've given us a little glimpse into the future and what's coming. Is there something that's big or major that's kind of maybe you want to announce or let the cat out of the bag here on the podcast, or is it just business as usual?
It's mostly business as usual. There's nothing big or major. We've got part 149 that's coming next year, and we're pretty much ready for part 149. We've been planning for that for 4 or 5 years. So there's a bit of, you know, up in the air, a bit of nervousness around what 149 is going to mean for organisations. And that's probably a whole another podcast. Mm-hmm. Next year, talking about with part 149, I won't go into details today, but it's essentially going to change how our relationship works with CASA. But for our members, it's going to be invisible. So we've been doing a lot of work in the background on that. The big thing next year is, as I said, our professional development seminar series. I think that's really successful. We got 450, 500 members to that last year. We're hoping to get, you know, 500 to 700 members to it this year, and get people through. And some real hands-on training for our maintainers is probably the most exciting thing happening next year. So if you're keen to do some more self-maintenance on your aircraft and you want to build your skills, watch out for some hands-on practical training being offered around the country by a range of really skilled, qualified engineers and maintainers. So a couple of good things, but mainly focusing on the training space. And as I said, giving back to our members, it's more about them and the tools and resources available to our members next year.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, if people want to know some more about RAOz and connect with you and the people in the business, where can they go?
They can check us out on our website, raoz.com.au. So just raaus.com.au, or drop us a line here in Canberra, 02-6280-4700. We'll happily take anybody's calls and direct people in the right direction. But the website is where all the information is. Of course, follow us on Facebook. Also got an Instagram account, so if you're more into pretty photos of aircraft and checking out what's going on, follow us at Instagram, Recreational Aviation Australia on Instagram, and same thing, RAOz on Facebook if you want to track us down on Facebook.
Sounds fantastic. And are you guys coming to Avalon next year?
We will be at Avalon. We're presenting a seminar at Avalon. One of our professional development seminars has been presented at Avalon, and we'll have our big stand and big space there adjacent to the runway, as we have for the last 5 or 6 Avalons. The last dozen years, we've been down to Avalon, so we really enjoy our time at Avalon, and looking forward to a big presence in Avalon for the whole week.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us here on the Australian Aviation Podcast. We really appreciate that. We look forward to seeing you down at Avalon, and maybe I'll catch you down there for a little interview on the fly as well.
Look forward to it. And Merry Christmas to everyone, all our members, everyone out there, for a great new year. And we look forward to catching up with everybody for a really big 2019. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Michael. We'll see you again soon, mate. Bye for now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another year has passed, and it certainly was a big one. How was it for you? Let us know your feedback in our socials. I wanted to take a minute here in the final podcast of 2018 to acknowledge all of the dedicated and passionate staff at Australian Aviation. For the listeners out there, you may not know that Australian Aviation actually won Australasia's Best Aviation Journalist of the Year for 2018. Andrew McLaughlin was the winner, and we congratulate him for his passion and dedication to his craft. Likewise, our lead photographer, Mark Jessup, won Best Aviation Photographer of the Year, and we can't wait to see more of his best for 2019 as well. Each and every one of the people that write for and work with Australian Aviation are true professionals that strive to bring the very best in reporting and coverage to this incredibly important industry that we're all part of. And I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge each and every one of you and publicly pass along a huge thank you. And to you, the listener, thank you for tuning into our podcast. There's some big plans for 2019, and I look forward to bringing you more shows and reporting on the stories that matter to you. And if you have an idea for a show, or you'd like us to interview a particular person, or you've just got some feedback, make sure you reach out to us at mail@australianaviation.com.au. Well, that just about wraps it up for 2018. Whatever you're doing over the summer break, stay safe, and we look forward to seeing you next year in 2019. I'm Robert Bruss, and until next time, happy aviating, and it's bye for now.